Life Audio.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Podcast. I am Ted Cluck, joined as always in studio by my good friend, my partner in radio, Barnabas Piper. Pipe, just you and me again today. The boy's on sabbatical, but he's as elusive as ever these days. So
he had an early morning counseling appointment, and I wasn't sure if he was doing the counseling or receiving the counseling, and it felt inappropriate to ask. Yeah. So I'm assuming doing being that he is the seasoned man of the cloth on this show.
Yeah, that's true. Do you do much counseling in your job?
Yes, but not. I mean, what's the difference between pastoral conversation and counseling?
That's a great question, dude. Yeah, that's a great question because I don't know. I think we're calling a lot of things counseling now that we used to just call conversations.
But, right. When somebody's like, hey, I'm struggling with something and they need prayer, or they just want to talk through how to think about something, like there's counsel there.
Yes.
But I don't like, to me, counseling seems more like this is somebody who is in the thick of something, you know, very difficult and ongoing, and you meet with them with regularity over time.
Yeah.
And so I would say I do a fairly small amount of that. And then there's a lot of the other thing where it's just people are at a rough spot in their marriage and they just want to talk for a little while, or figuring out job stuff, or not sure about the direction in life, or don't find any joy in the Lord, or whatever.
Yeah.
And that doesn't seem like counseling as much as just pastoring,
being a good friend, etc. Yeah, but social calculus wise, here's the interesting thing, right? So if you say to your podcast co-host, I have a counseling appointment, that's unassailable, right? But if you were to say to your podcast co-host, I'm missing the show again because I'm getting breakfast with a buddy, and we might talk about his marriage, or we might talk about, you know, a job change that he has coming up or whatever, like, it's more unassailable to call it a counseling appointment than to call it, like, I'm just hanging out with a friend.
And on that front, it's actually to the pastor's benefit because, you know, there's kind of two impressions of people in the clergy. One is they're the hardest working people alive. And I'd say like 10% of people think that, maybe 5%.
Yeah.
And then there's the what do these guys do between Sundays impression, which is the other 90 to 95% of people. So when you can say, I do a lot of counseling,
right,
it fills in your other days significantly. Obviously, there's a lot more to the job. Maybe not, obviously. There is a lot more to the job.
Yeah, should be. You know.
But when people's impression is you spend all day having coffee with folks and talking to people, how is that different than a therapist, except that they're getting paid more than we are and they don't drink as much coffee?
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, the optics on it are important. And speaking of optics, I hate for Ronald to miss this show because we're going to talk about people photographing themselves and people's relationships with photographs and how that's changed over time. We're also going to talk about an interesting payment arc thing that you brought up, Pipe, and we'll do all of that after this quick break.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
All right, Pipe, we're back. You and I both have teenage kids. I have a kid who's 20 and a kid who's 17. You have teenage daughters who are in high school, and you mentioned this idea of a payment arc, and you ran it by me off air, and it sounded like it really resonated. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of what this is, and then we'll talk about it?
Yeah, so I made the observation, you know, thinking about different points in life and then observing my kids as they're approaching adulthood, that there's a, you know, like in teenager, when you're a teenager and then into your, you know, college years, early 20s, you buy the cheapest of everything. You know,
yes.
You still think McDonald's is good. You buy what you can afford. You're cheap. Which also means like you buy 17 pairs of shoes every 2 years because you burn through them because you bought the $8 flip-flops or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Then you pivot from that to, oh, quality matters, and you start buying high-end stuff. And sometimes it's quality. Sometimes it's ego. It's brand-related. Yeah. So not I don't want the cheapest. I want the coolest or the best. So then you overspend on everything. That's often where you end up in credit card debt.
Mm-hmm.
Then somewhere around, I don't know, wherever maturity comes in, their late 20s, 30s, you start to learn about value. So you do a little market research. You're going to spend the money, but you're not necessarily going to get the top end thing. You're going to get the best version for the money. You have a better sense of your budget and a better sense of the thing. So you buy value.
Mm.
And then as you age, you get cheap again.
Mm-hmm.
and that, you know, that like you end up back at like Applebee's instead of the nice new restaurant in town. You end up being like, we don't need that high end stuff. Let's just, you know, like my dad just wears Dockers or whatever, you know, like you just sort of get you're just going to go cheap. You're going to buy used. You're going to do whatever. So it's the arc from cheap to most expensive to value to cheap.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating, dude. And I've got so many questions vis-a-vis your dad, but also I want to ask you a kid-related thing. Something I started noticing about Tristan, my oldest especially, and I don't mean to, like, kill him on this. It's mostly his friend group. Like, when they will go out to eat, and I noticed this a year or two ago when he was finishing up high school / starting college. Like, they don't go cheap. Like when I was that age, it was like Taco Bell and McDonald's, and we felt like real high rollers, just like being out of the house, spending some money. They go to like sit down places, and like he'll come back from like the other night he played tennis with his friends and then like grab some dinner. And I'm like, oh, where'd you go? And he's like, you know, naming these sit down places that are like places where I take my wife for a date, you know, and like it's where he and all of his sweaty buddies like flop down to like get some dinner after tennis. And I was like, I don't know how you're making this work financially, you know, like I feel like I couldn't afford those places until I was 30, but somehow some way it's working out. And I've noticed he and his friend group have done this for a while. Are your girls sort of into that stage of life yet?
Only to a degree. I think it has a lot to do with group of friends. I mean, I just like to point out that you have a son named Tristan who plays tennis. So there's a certain trend there that I'm noticing as well. But I also realize like you didn't raise a tennis playing Tristan. You raised a football playing and not snobby, you know,
exactly
sweater
exactly.
over the shoulders kid. But I do think friend group has a lot to do with it. No, my older daughter is the one who can drive herself around, and like she and her friends are very much in the, like, they're just very teenager in the same way that I would have been, where like they go to a bonfire by a lake, or they like hang out in the Speedway parking lot drinking Slurpees or whatever they call those things.
Yeah,
Slurpee is the 7-Eleven version.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they'll go get ice cream. They drink a ton of coffee, you know, whatever bougie coffees.
Yeah.
And only occasionally will they, like, they'll go out to eat at, like, a sports bar kind of place nearby. But that's not their norm. So I would still put her very firmly in the cheap category.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to, like, buying clothes, she is moving from cheap into the very high end, where she's like, I want the $57 t-shirt.
Yeah.
Which is not better than the $12 t-shirt.
Exactly. And that's a fascinating conversation to have. So I think it's a little bit different with boys. My guys are very utilitarian about their fashion still. Like, I don't think Tristan would go $57 on a t-shirt. I think that may be more the purview of girls, as is like coffee as destination thing. You know, I think I told this story on the program recently, having traveled with my college students, like getting coffee is a part-time job for them. You know, they do it multiple times a day. It takes forever. It's an activity. Like it's a destination thing. And the order is complex. If your order is simple, you're sort of, you know, less than. The order is like a personality test. It's like the Enneagram, you know, that little
so
sticker
true.
That comes with the coffee. It's like paragraph length that says some things about you, you know. Like this is the experience of getting coffee with college students nowadays. So I have a dad related question. Did your dad ever go through in this arc of payment? Did he ever go through like a moment of kind of being a ponce? Like, hey, I got myself some new jeans. They were $120 bucks, you know.
Yeah, fun John Piper story, or rather sort of snapshot. He was that guy in college, like high school and college. So I don't think he was like loud about it verbally, but he was like a sharp dresser, and he drove a 1966 gold fastback convertible.
Oh, let's go.
In the like maybe up through his seminary years, so like up through the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
And so like picture like late 60s, early 70s, like he would wear, you know, kind of like the checkered pants and the, you know, the wider collared shirts. And he was, you know, he wasn't like gold chains and flashy, but like kind of whatever the preppy version of 1969, 1970 was.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And then he went to Germany and got his doctorate and like has not taken off his tweed coat since.
Yeah, so, dude, that's wild.
There was
Germany like reset his persona.
Well, it was that, and then I think during his time teaching post doctorate is also when there was a kind of a theological development there of and he became very kind of at odds with wealth, at least personally and kind of for everyone else too.
Yeah, definitely, dude. That's fascinating. I've seen some of the same things in my own dad, in that. I know that when he was in college, he had like a 1965 Mustang. It was yellow. I've seen pictures of it. And like late 60s, early 70s. Yeah, he was like the fashionable guy in like bell bottoms, the big mustache, you know, the big mutton chop sideburns, like kind of a cool hat. Like he was that guy. But now he's like anti-fashion. He's like Bill Belichick, you know?
He's just like Dickies every day.
Well, yeah, more like jeans or like even like workout gear or whatever. And it's not sort of new stuff, you know. And I don't know. I just sometimes I wonder where that fashionable guy went. You know what I mean? Or what changed it? Maybe it's like a career in ministry thing, because right after college he did some time in ministry before he became a pilot. So maybe it's the ministry that like hammers the fashion out of you, although it doesn't seem to be now. Like
that
you can swing.
That's true. Every you know, pastors everywhere are wearing the $200 Erwin McManus t-shirts, but
exactly.
There's something to be said for just like, you know, because we make fun of old men, you know, 50 plus.
Mm-hmm.
Which we're both fast approaching, so at some point we're gonna have to pivot on who we make fun of, but
exactly.
Men who are too old to dress the way they do. And that could be 35-year-old. That could be a 55-year-old. That could be an 80-year-old. Granted, I don't make fun of a lot of 80-year-olds because I'm like, at 80?
Yeah.
If you want to wear like joggers and a hoodie you know, you want to dress like Erwin McManus at 80, go get it. I'm proud of you.
Yeah, that's right. You've been around for 8 decades. You've earned it.
If you're doing it at 60, you look like an idiot.
Yeah, for sure.
But there comes a point where like, fashion, you either lean in or you punt. There's not a lot of middle ground, which is why most dads look like dads. Like, you know, I was scrolling through Instagram the other day, and there was some, there was a video about somebody throwing a dad-themed party for their neighborhood. Basically everybody just had to show up in their best stereotypical dad uniform.
Yeah.
And so it's like knee length jorts, crew socks, white shoes, oversized short sleeve button down, untucked fanny pack, you know, all this stuff. And I'm like,
yeah.
Okay, I don't see a lot of dads dressed like that. Maybe I don't go to Disney World enough, but
yeah.
But also when you look at that, you're like, that's a dad look.
Dude, that's wild. And that the concept of that party as an ironic thing, that's the most like affluent Nashville thing ever. Like, because the subtext in it is we're all way too cool to look like this, but we're also probably like old enough to be actual dads. Like, these are the kind of dads that you see at like, you know, the biscuit barn in Franklin where breakfast is $74 a plate and they're wearing like their black CrossFit t-shirt with a flat brim cap and the, you know, the real squared off beard. And, you know, so they're kind of doing the dad thing ironically while also being actual dads.
That's right. But you're also a dad.
Right. It's just strange that like being a dad has become like this memeable thing for white people. You know what I mean? It's kind of crazy.
It seems like it, you know, so stereotypically for a long time, like I'm too young to be a grandparent was kind of a thing, especially for grandmas, you know, like, oh, don't call me grandma. I feel like we're now at that point with dad. Like you're 39 years old and you have a 2-year-old.
Yeah.
And like, you don't want to look like a dad. I'm like, you're 39 years old and you're carrying a diaper bag. Like, what else do you think you look like?
Exactly.
And I don't mean that as an insult. Like,
right. Yeah. Like,
dads are dads. It's what we do.
Dads are dads. It's what we do. It's a noble thing. You know, you go through that like decade when your kids are young where, I don't know, you're carrying sippy cups and like there's a little patina of like Cheerio dust on your shirt, and it's kind of a badge like of honor, you know?
You always like a little spit up or a little drool somewhere on you. And I have this distinct memory of being in my mid-20s, and, you know, we had driven from Chicago up to Minneapolis to visit family, and I'm unloading our car, and I pull out it's a Hello Kitty backpack with like Barbies hanging out of it, and I'm carrying a cooler full of juice boxes in the other hand, and I'm like, you know, it's just sort of one of those, oh, this is who I am moments.
Yes.
Where
yeah,
you know, so at like 26 or whatever, like I'm just fully dad of tiny children.
Yeah.
And and like I wasn't cool. I wasn't.
Right.
You can't be cool and carry Hello Kitty backpacks. I'm sorry.
No, and, you're right, man.
And that's okay.
It is. And the kind of the cool thing about that moment is you sort of, I mean, there's a spiritual component. We could take it real serious, but like you do kind of die to yourself, and that's part and parcel of being a parent, right? So part and parcel with having kids and caring for them is you spend less time thinking about yourself, right? So yeah, your sense of like being on the razor's edge of fashion is probably going away while you're a dad. Or it should, you know, I mean, if
to be fair, I was only ever on like the razor's handle of fashion, but yes.
Yeah, exactly. Razor adjacent, you know.
That's right.
I was
nearby on the counter. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But which is why like when I do see these like ultra fashionable Franklin, Tennessee dads, I'm like, do you even know your kid's name? You know, you seem to spend a lot of time like looking at yourself.
They better, because they probably made it up.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. He's named after like the, you know, the bass player in some band you've never heard of. But
I don't know how much those parents are doing that stuff for themselves versus I think some of it is like they don't want to be embarrassment to their kids.
Yeah.
But the fact is your kids are just going to be embarrassed by you at some point anyway.
100%.
Like, I've worked pretty hard not to intentionally embarrass my kids, just out of like, I always thought it was, I just didn't ever like it when parents would just sort of be super awkward and make their kids feel dumb. So I was like, I'm not going to do that, you know?
Yeah.
Like, oh, is this your girlfriend kind of thing? I was like, no,
I'm not
doing that stuff. I'll try to just be even keel. But the fact is that like, they still don't want to hang out with me the way that they did when they were 8.
Yeah.
I have a good relationship with them. We have a good time together, but like they need time with their friends and I'm going to give them their time. Like I'm not going to come down and be like, who needs snacks? You know?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And there's just comes a time where like, they're just not that impressed by you and their friends aren't either. Like,
yeah,
if I dress super fashionably, my teenage daughter's friends are not like, your dad's a sharp dresser. I'm just a dad. Like, there's a whole category of dad.
You cease to exist. Yeah, and it's kind of nice. Yeah.
You're just wallpaper.
Yep. You're wallpaper, you're beige, and it's great. You know, like,
it's appropriate. Really, like, great. Why should I want my daughter's friends to think anything about me other than, oh, that's Grace's dad.
Yeah,
like, that's entirely right.
He opened the door. He let us in. That's the extent of it. No, that's good, dude. I've got another question on that, and then the picture thing right after this break. All right, dude. I had a laser specific question on this, and then we cut to the break and I forgot what it was. So let's talk about pictures. I've been wanting to talk about people's relationships with pictures, and this kind of came to my attention while watching my friends get ready for graduation parties. So I had a couple of friends who had kids graduate high school this last month. And these graduations were like exercises in going through thousands of pictures and picking the right pictures to convey the right thing about the right kid. And, you know, for them, the pictures were really important. For everyone else, the pictures were, as you said, wallpaper, you know, something you walk by for 2.5 seconds at a party and glance at. But it made me think about how, for my oldest, he's 20. He kind of came of age right at the end of like analog pictures. So right at the end of like taking some pictures, going to Walgreens, getting them, you know, published or printed or whatever we used to call it, developed is the word we used to call it. And so we have all these boxes of like pictures of him, but Maxim came along right at the front end of like taking pictures on your phone. So most of our pictures of Maxim are like digital. Right. And I gotta tell you, we don't have much of a relationship with our pictures. I mean, they kind of get taken and then forgotten. I don't know where I'm going with this other than people seem to have a really interesting relationship with their pictures. Oh, I remember what the dad thing was. Let's get this real quick and then, yes. And then we'll get back to the picture thing. I think the internet has made it so that for a particular kind of dad, you can, if you do the work, like if you do the homework, you can be somewhat like up to date on like, you know, meme culture and knowing what people are talking about on the internet. My question to you is, do you know dads who try to do this and do you try to do it?
The answer to the first question is yes, I do know dads who try to do it. And it's almost always at one end of the spectrum or the other. It's either with their first kid who is coming of age, so they're still trying to keep up, or it's their last kid, you know, they have four kids or something, and there's a bit of an age gap, and they're like they're trying to sort of make the most of it.
Yeah.
It's never the middle kids. And it's usually, yeah, and it usually doesn't last. Like, so middle school, trying a lot harder, get into high school, the kids just outpace us. That's what it comes down to. The answer to the second question is no, I don't try. Like, I pick up on stuff here and there.
Yeah.
You know, I'm familiar with how to use Urban Dictionary. So when my kids say stuff, I will quietly look it up to be like, what the heck? But it feels more like Urban Dictionary is just parents Google Translate.
Yeah.
You know, so you can do it from Spanish to English. You can also do it from teenage to adult language. And sometimes you're like, oh, that's horrifying, the words that just came out of their mouth. And sometimes you're like, oh, that's an expression that is as dumb as some of the stuff that I said when I was 17, you know?
Yeah.
And so there's I don't try to keep up. I do try to not be utterly confused.
Yeah. It's interesting. I was thinking the other day about how much information just sort of trickles down to me from my students. So like a week ago, I have these two guys in my program who I talk about music with, and they texted me and it was like a PSA. They were basically like, Cluck, hey, just FYI, Taylor Swift and Matty Healy are dating. Matty Healy's from the 1975. And I was like, oh, thanks guys. Like, I would have never heard that. Like, I would have come back to school in the fall not knowing that. And it's not like it enhances my life to know it, but I thought it was kind of sweet that they just kind of wanted to drift it across my transom, you know?
I'd like to earn some dad cred here and say, I don't know who or what the 1975 is.
Yeah.
That sounds like it could be a bar.
Yeah.
It sounds like it could be a war movie.
Yeah,
about,
exactly.
You know, post-Vietnam.
Post-Vietnam, yeah.
It could be a band, but I don't know what genre this band would be in.
Yeah.
And Maddie sounds like a lady's name to me. So I'm going full dad right now, and the thing is, I'm not even really being ironic about it.
That's good dad stuff, dude. That's really good. Let me explain the 1975, because I really do enjoy this band. And they've been around. I'm going to get the timetable wrong. I feel like they've been around for a decade, because I feel like when we were doing our little stint in France, that's when I became aware of the 1975. They're British. They're a pop band. Truly, their songs are unique. I really enjoy them. I think Matty Healy's a good songwriter. I don't know music, dude. So like all the Nashville hipsters who are listening could tell me all the reasons why my take sucks about the 1975, but I just enjoy listening to them.
I think we have more listeners who yell Freebird than who are Nashville hipsters. So I think you're okay.
I'm good. Yeah. But Maddie is like, you know how all rock stars are like older than you think they are? They're like 38, but they act like they're 26, you know? He probably falls into that category, but he's got some natural charisma. And I'm kind of just interested by people who are charismatic in any walk of life, and that would apply to him. And he's got the kind of typical rock star resume of, I don't know, substance abuse and having dated a bunch of famous people already. So like his sort of alignment with Taylor Swift is, I guess it's kind of interesting. But
his career arc is, I now want to be the subject of songs rather than write the songs. Is that what he's going for?
Yeah. Yeah, and kind of the general take about this relationship is like the breakup albums on both sides are going to be spectacular. You know, we're going to get some good like breakup media as a result of this relationship that I'm sure is doomed to failure. But I don't know. I thought it was kind of sweet that they wanted me to know about that. But then I was like, I'm 47 years old. I probably shouldn't know about that. You know, not that it's bad to, but it doesn't make any sense for me to know about it. So you're not knowing about the 1975 is actually kind of that scans as appropriate to me. I'll say that.
So I'm doing a little internet research right now. And first I looked up the 1975 and it says the band was formed in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, that's cool. Yeah. Then I looked up Matty Healy and it says he was born in 1989.
Okay.
And if my math is correct, that makes him 13 years old in 2002. So is he a late addition to this band, or were they like a genuine teenage garage band who then hit it big?
Yeah, I think more of that. I actually have no idea. Like, I don't know. You know, I haven't done the research on the 1975. I remember picking up one of their records about a decade ago and really enjoying it. And I kind of picked it up under... It was under the old model of media. Like, I think I heard a song on the radio, which makes me sound 94 years old, and I liked the song, so I picked up the album, and I've kind of been in on them a little bit ever since. But, I don't know.
Turns out they did form a band as teenagers. So I will say I have gained – I don't know anything about them. I don't know that I've ever heard any of their music, but I dig the fact that they started playing music together in what Wikipedia calls secondary school and what we in the United States I think would call high school. But that's pretty cool that they're still performing, and I hope Taylor doesn't break the band up.
Yeah, no, I know. She might do a Yoko Ono thing on the 1975. That'd be crazy. Here's a weird question, man. And this is probably like, we're probably all kinds of horrible for even considering this. Why do you think she's so bad at relationships? Like, the relationship thing has never really worked out for her. I kind of find that fascinating.
Yeah. We might be terrible for asking. We're just saying the quiet part out loud.
Yeah.
Or maybe the thing that everybody says to their friends and not on a podcast. But
right.
I have to imagine that being the most famous pop star in the world, you know, her or Beyonce. I mean, she's like top two or three.
Yeah.
Makes it impossible to have a normal relationship.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember, I was watching a movie recently and it was about somebody got famous and the comment they made was, they're like, fame changes you, but it really changes the people around you.
Oh, that's good.
So
yeah, that's really good.
You know, it was a documentary about, who was it? It was a Scottish singer. I can't remember his name. I walked in on it while my wife was watching it, and I was like, that's a really insightful comment because it changes how people interact with you, how people perceive you. They dehumanize you. So like Taylor Swift is no longer a person to the people around her or anybody she meets. And then if you want to mix things, you know, you want to complicate things, she is an incredibly wealthy, famous, and powerful woman.
Mm-hmm.
And there are not many men who equal her on any of those fronts.
Yeah, that's a
great
point.
Which means that she is the most famous, most wealthy, and most powerful person in every relationship. And that creates a weird dynamic, especially because men are often insecure.
Sure.
But anytime there's a great disparity in that, it can cause tensions.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and just a natural sense of competition or whatever. And also, like, inherent in any healthy relationship, and you know this from being married and I do too, like, you have to be able to look at the other person and listen to the other person for long periods of time. And in fact, that's one of the more joyful aspects of a good relationship, right? Like, you want
are going well, that happens a lot.
It happens a lot, and it's good, and it's right, and it's normal, but it's at odds with fame, right? So the fame paradigm says, look at yourself, think about yourself, position yourself, leverage yourself, which is why this is so gross for pastors, right? And it's so gross to see, like, so many pastors pursuing this, because fame is so sort of narcissistic, for lack of a better term. I mean, you're gazing at yourself, and you're checking your numbers and all that stuff on the regular. So, you know, being someone who's very concerned with fame is at odds with being somebody who could be concerned for someone else, you know, unless you're really like a unicorn and you're really just amazing at doing this. And if that's the case, it's probably God given, you know?
When it's why, like, if you look at Hollywood, I think what you're saying is why so many of, you know, there obviously celebrity marriages often break down, and I think probably at a higher rate than normal people marriages.
Mm-hmm.
But those people who are in Hollywood or musicians who have been married for a long time are usually married to somebody who nobody's ever heard of.
Yeah.
And it's because they have married somebody who there isn't the competition. That person probably has a different sort of capacity to sort of bring the famous person back to normalcy.
Yeah.
You know? So like Dolly Parton's husband, who he's an incredibly private figure, but they've been married for like 60 years or something.
Wow.
And he's just he is the normal for, like, so she has public persona and then a very private life where they can be themselves, and I'm glad I know nothing about it.
Yeah,
that seems entirely appropriate. And I think, you know, like Hugh Jackman is married to somebody who, again, wife, mom, they have sort of a not reclusive but very private family life. Those kinds of people, I'm like, yeah, that's that seems necessary to make it in this world. And I also think if you are Taylor Swift, if you're a woman, it's probably harder to meet a guy who fits that bill.
Yeah.
Partly because of relational dynamics, partly because of how guys view you, partly because of how what men are looking for in relationships. And so, like, there's just the whole dynamic is just off for that to be a thing that's easy to find or even possible to find.
Well, yeah, and if she was going to try to date a peer or an equal, like, financially, It would be like Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, and Michael Jordan. Like those would be
all,
like the three
profoundly
names.
Profoundly healthy men.
Oh yeah, yeah, great dudes. I don't know. I don't know any of those men. They might be great dudes, but yeah.
I think we can say with pretty great definitiveness they're not, based on public persona. I think two of them are married. I'm not sure about Michael, but
yeah, yeah.
Well, and I think the other thing is once you're that famous, you can't do normal anymore. So the people who I mentioned, they entered this committed relationship pre-fame and navigated the rise together.
Yeah.
Whereas, so like they remember together what it was like to be broke or to be not famous or to work as a waiter or whatever.
Yeah.
Like once you're a gazillionaire and famous, you can't like get on a dating site and just meet normal people. You can't.
Yeah.
You can't go to church like a normal person. You can't go to a bar and meet people. You can't do any of the ways that people meet folks.
Right.
Because that ship has sailed.
I have questions about that. And I'm going to get to those questions right after I segue us pipe into our third ad break. And I do so with a great attitude. So this is me saying, let's take a break. And then we'll get to some more stuff right after. All right. I have a fame related question for you related to what you just said. I've long had this theory that everybody who's famous is famous by choice, right? Especially now, especially in the era we're in. Like if you're famous, it's because you made calculated moves to get yourself there. Now I can think of a few people who that's untrue of, namely your dad. Being one of them, if we're talking about Christian famous, you know, I how old was your dad when his first book dropped? Dang near 50, right?
No, he was a lot younger than that. But
yeah,
I mean, he was about 50 when he got famous.
Yeah, that's
so his that's like, Desiring God was probably his first book of significance in terms of trade, and I think that came out in like 86, 87. So he would have been 40-ish.
Yeah, so he kind of became famous under the old paradigm, which was just you do a thing, you make something, a bunch of people decide they like it. Somebody else is doing the marketing for you. Like that was back when publishers marketed books. So the publisher's doing the marketing. So it was a different paradigm. What the good old days. Yeah, exactly. Before the marketing plan was just like tweet about it incessantly, you know. What do you think of that theory that under the nowadays paradigm, and I'm thinking kind of ministry here, but even more broadly, people who are famous because they've chosen it.
I think it's, I don't think it's quite that clean cut, but I think the consequences of success are more obvious now than ever. So for example, I think there are people who genuinely love music or genuinely love acting. And so they get into those things for the love of the performance, the art, et cetera. And fame is a consequence or a byproduct of success in that. Now more than ever, decisions are made along the way though. If I do this, this is the possible outcome.
Yeah.
Whereas like in the 80s and the 90s, like when my dad's, you know, became Christian famous.
Yeah.
You put books out into the world and you just kind of hoped they worked.
Yes.
And then maybe you would get a letter or a phone call from an organization saying, hi, we're putting on a conference.
Yeah.
You know, in 12 months, would you be interested in speaking at this conference?
Right.
And, you know, and then they would like fax over an itinerary and stuff like that. Yeah. And so it just...
It's so quaint.
It felt more like you know, farming where you sow a bunch of seeds and maybe something grows if the conditions are right. And now it feels more like a lab.
Yeah.
Where if we include this ingredient under these conditions, this is the likely outcome. And so I think you're right in kind of the overarching sense of very few people arrive at famous without having made decisions along the way to, like, this is a choose your own adventure, and they chose that road. They're like, oh, this is the road that leads more likely to fame. I don't think that it means they all set out to be famous.
Yeah. I guess I do. I miss the old model, though, where your dad did that book because he wanted to do it, and he wanted to do the best book he could possibly do, and the stuff was really meaningful for him, and he had studied, and he probably took his time on it. I mean, it probably wasn't something he turned and burned in 3.5 months, you know. And then he put it out there, and to your point, yeah, he just waited for, like, the phone call and the facts to come in, as opposed to, like, chasing it, you know, and promoting and sending emails to people and asking for reviews. And I don't know, like, I miss, there's something real kind of austere and respectable about that old model, where it seemed like fame was more of a consequence, right? Like, if you had talent, maybe the fame would find you, as opposed to, like, most of these guys don't have any talent, but they want the fame real bad, you know?
Yeah, the variables on that are a little tricky, though, simply because, like, the ugly side of what you're saying, mm-hmm. The ugly side of the market that mm-hmm. that existed in the time you're talking about, is that publishers could make people famous.
That is true. Yeah.
You know, like, there was, I remember hearing an interview, probably it was in the early days of podcasting, so maybe early 2000s, with a guy who, he talks about how, you know, he was writing kind of like, kind of an early Malcolm Gladwell-y kind of mm-hmm. stuff. So we're talking like early to mid 90s. So well before Gladwell, and publishers, he's like, yeah, they just signed me to like an $80,000 advance or $100,000 advance.
Yeah.
Because of the model of publishing, like, recouping that was a thing they could do.
Sure.
You know, or they were confident enough they could do it. Whereas now, you know, those days are gone. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
You don't get that kind of advance unless you've proven to be a bestseller, and even then they're reluctant unless, you know, you're signing a 3 or 5 book contract or whatever.
Yeah.
And so there was just a model. So from the creator's side of things, fame felt accidental. From the industry side of things, it was still a lab. It was like big pharma versus basement laboratory.
No, that's a good point. And it was like, back in those days, it was like the publisher deciding, okay, we're going to put our money behind this project. We're going to give it a big push. Like, this guy's going to be on every radio show. He's going to be doing some TV. We're making this happen.
We're going to do a book tour. Yeah. We're going to pay for placement in every Barnes & Noble. So it's going to be, you know, front of store.
Yep.
And so forth. And now, you know,
none of that stuff happens.
Yeah, I mean, when was the last time a best-selling author ended up on, like, late-night TV or Good Morning America? Now, you'll still see some on, like, Oprah or some of these, like, morning TV shows. But even then, it's like,
it's not real writers, though. It's like, I don't know, self-help guys or business guys. It's not
romance books and stuff like that. Yeah, there's no literature that's being pitched there or thoughtful books that's being pitched there.
Yeah.
Podcasts have replaced that. And podcasts, like, I mean, as an author, I say yes to as many podcast interviews as I can. You know, like, I say no if I'm like, A, you look crazy, or B, I just can't do it time-wise.
Yeah.
And I don't think the impact of those is very significant.
No.
I mean, we wrote a book as podcast hosts.
Yeah.
We have hosted this podcast for almost 10 years.
Yeah.
And our sales suck.
by pure nature of the numbers, we have one of the most successful podcasts in the world. Like, if you're just doing listen notes or whatever metric you're following, you know, we're in all these countries, we've got all these great, like, download numbers or whatever, but it's like, did that translate into book sales? It did not. And, I mean, the book was largely, like, I don't know, a $13 version of what we do on here, you know? Like, if you enjoy this, you'll definitely enjoy that. And yet, yeah, there's no one-to-one. There's no way to translate it. And you would think that this model would be the perfect way to sell a book. Right, because there's something baked into podcasting that's built on knowability, right? And it's the same reason you go to a conference, you hear an author, and you pay full price for the book from a table in the back versus not buying the book at all, right? Because you've heard this guy bloviate for 45 minutes and you feel like you know him. So now you're like, oh, I got to have that book or I got to try it or whatever. You would think that would work for this format, but it doesn't, because I just think the podcast thing is so, it's so loud and it's so crowded. And there are so many like middle-aged white guys telling you to look at so many different products. It's just, it all goes into the category of noise at this point.
And to clarify, our book sales are like, they're exactly what they're kind of in market line. When I say suck, I just mean like versus having been bestsellers and whatever.
Yeah.
But I think the other thing is, and publishers don't know what to do with this. So this is not an insult at our publisher or any particular publisher. The translation between mediums is really confusing.
Yeah.
We do, statistically, we are a top 5-7% podcast of all the podcasts in the world.
Yeah.
Now, we're a far cry from the top 1% or 2%, but that second tier, we're right there.
Yeah.
And that, like you said, you look at those, you look at those numbers, you go, this should translate to book sales, except that listening to us change topics every 30 seconds, talk over each other, make, you know, irreverent jokes, forget ad breaks, all the things that we do so consistently for, you know, for 30 to 40 minutes at a time, has nothing to do with reading.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, it's the same with like athlete memoirs or book or musician books. So like, if I'm trying to remember who it was, there was a really prominent pop star who put out a book a few years ago. Maybe it was like Christina Aguilera or somebody like that.
Yeah.
And like, it sold like trash. Publisher paid her a ton of money, sold like garbage. Why? Because listening to 4 minutes of a song that makes you happy or makes you dance.
Yeah.
And reading somebody talk about themselves for 280 pages are different universes.
Well, by contrast, and I agree with that 100%, I remember when Keith Richards' biography came out about a decade ago, I bought it and I read it and it was like presidential length, and everybody bought that memoir. You know, everybody read the Keith Richards memoir, and I wonder if the difference is Keith Richards mattered in a time when people read, you know, versus Christina Aguilera mattering to an audience in a time where people don't read. I don't know, but it's interesting.
I think Keith Richards has always, like, there's always been stories about him. Like, he's the the myth, the legend. I mean, so Dave Grohl's memoir came out a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Great book, listeners. I would highly recommend the audiobook because he reads it and it's actually got more life to it. But
interesting.
He's another one who, that you look at that and you're like, man, there's some stories to tell there, like the eras and these different things.
Yeah.
So, I think some of it has to do with generation. Some of it has to do with that. Some of it has to do with the kind of music that is put out. Although Dave Grohl is basically pop, you know? So,
but
I think it's the storyteller aspect. But yeah, there's just, it is an impossible thing for a publisher to look at a person who's famous in one, you know, one medium.
Yeah.
And transition that to, this is going to be a really good selling book.
Yeah. I mean,
it doesn't even work for pastors anymore. You know, for a long time, pastor of a large church, pastor who oversaw a big network, like there was sort of guaranteed sales there.
Yeah.
Not anymore. You know, like there's, and I think a ton of it has to do with the leveling of the market in terms of anybody can publish anything at any time.
Yep.
I think people have so many options that to stand out above the others is nearly impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, I think about books that are absolutely bestsellers. So like All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr.
Yeah.
Absolutely phenomenal book, you know, one of the best written books I've read in the last, I don't know, 10-12 years.
Yeah.
And most of the people I know have not read it. Those who have read it love it, and most people haven't. Like, that's just math.
Well, and none of the
and
none of the people who have read it would recognize Anthony Doerr if he walked into their office. Whereas, I don't know, I'm thinking an era ago, so let's say like 1980s and 1990s, you had Tom Wolfe, David Foster Wallace, Don DeLillo, you know, kind of the end of the guy slipping my mind.
It was like Tom Clancy.
Yeah. I mean, you had all these authors that, like, the average American could name them and even kind of know what they look like, you know, whereas now there's no famous author. I mean, there are books that do well every once in a while. You know, that Gentleman in Moscow thing, which I found to be, like, mind-numbingly boring. That did well. Had a cool title. The guy's got a cool name. Whatever. But if you walked in the room, you wouldn't know him. You know,
well, and books have long been, you know, we talk about how people do things just to, you know, kind of cast their image, you know, they're curating their image. Books have always been that, you know, people going back to like the 1700s.
Yeah.
If there was a popular author, because books carry with them an intellectual aura.
Yes.
And so if you say you love a book that is intellectually stimulating or popular, I think that's why, like, I haven't read Gentleman in Moscow. I tried to listen to it and was like, this is not a good audiobook.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try to read it. But I think that's part of the reason that one did so well is because it is it ups your intellectual status.
Sure.
To say,
you could talk about it.
Yeah. I loved this book. You know, whereas if you're like, man, I love 50 Shades of Grey, nobody's impressed.
That's true.
Like, that one doesn't do anything for your image.
Dude, and here's the magic of A Gentleman in Moscow. I mean, it was literally like the triad of cool title, right? Like, it's an elite title. It's a really great title. The author had a cool name, Amor Towles, right? Kind of ethnic, kind of not boring. You don't really know, whatever. Like, cool name, looks cool on a cover. And then the cover design was elite. And you add those three things together. And then you fold in what you just said, which is this makes me look like a smarter person by nature of talking about it. And you have a book that sells really well, despite being really boring. Like, that book took 100 pages to get started, right? And I'm not knocking books like that. There are great slow burn stories out there, but that was not one of them. It was bad. And I wanted to like it, you know? I really, like... And I should have liked it because I care about Eastern Europe and I'm in the book business and all. There are all these reasons why I should have liked it, but it was bad. But I just think it was impeccably marketed. You know, you got cool title, cool sounding author, good cover design. It gets a push and it becomes the thing.
And as long as we're chasing this thing, so the two books that we've mentioned, All the Light We Cannot See and Gentleman in Moscow, they both became paradigms for how other books... So you can now go on Amazon and find 25 to 100 other books that look exactly like those.
Yep.
Same typeface, same cover design, same everything.
Same kind of cadency title, like ambiguously cadency title. Like, yeah, totally.
Yeah, it's, you know, one of them, A Gentleman in Moscow sounds like a John le Carré spy novel.
I wish it had been one.
Yeah. Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. It has sort of that sort of crisp, clear, innocuous title. All the Light We Cannot See sounds super metaphorical. So those are there's sort of those paradigms.
Yeah.
There's the way that they did the black and white image on A Gentleman in Moscow, and then the sort of blue-hued image of what was it, Mont-Saint-Michel or something like that in All the Light We Cannot See. And you, these are just now paradigms for design.
That's right.
Yeah. Because publishers are just grasping at options and they're like, man, that worked. So we're just gonna run it back 25 times until it stops working.
Yeah, it's a copycat league, you know, which is why when someone does something actually clever and actually different and actually unique, it's like how every Christian book cover now looks like, the Ted Ortland book. I'm blanking on the title. The Gentle
and Lowly?
Yeah, Gentle and Lowly. It's all that kind of like impressionistic, kind of blurry painting, very soft and kind of welcoming looking.
Yeah, muted and neutral tones.
Muted and neutral. Yeah. Like, you're barely going to notice this book cover. But it's funny, man. It's probably always been that
way. Well, that's because we did the Orange Radical thing. You know, for 5 to 10 years after 2007 or whatever. Like, there's You can, if you've been around publishing, you can peg books by era. You can usually get them within about totally. 5 years.
Yeah.
Now, it was harder. It was harder earlier because the era is extended longer and there was less, you know, kind of, there was less or fewer options.
Yeah.
But yeah, at this point, you're like, oh, that's this kind of book.
Yep.
From this. And I got in an argument with my younger daughter. We went to McKay's. So listeners, McKay's is this massive used book and music store.
Absolutely love it.
Two or three across the Southeast. And it's like an excursion and it's amazing.
It is amazing.
And she loves fantasy fiction, which I'm totally fine with, but she just grabs books and is like, what about this one? And I'm like, no, not that one. And she's like, why? And I said, cause I can tell by the cover that that's not a good book. And she's like, Dad, you tell me not to judge a book by the cover.
Yeah.
So I'm like, touche.
But we do also, it all the time.
I'm not judging a book by the cover. I'm judging a book by 15 years in publishing and having read 1,000 books, which means I know exactly what that book is and it's total trash.
Yeah.
And she just thinks I'm being a hypocrite. But you can look at a book and go, no, that one is like smut demonic fantasy, not like world building creative character fantasy.
No, you're right, man. And it's interesting how accurately you can judge a book by its cover. I wish that wasn't true, but it is. Pipe, we've gone almost an hour on this show.
None of the topics we set out to talk about.
On none of the topics we set out to talk about, but it was an enjoyable journey. Pipe, I'm going to say that we've done what we always do. Yeah, what we always do on this program. We've wandered to and fro throughout some topics, and until next time.
We want to take a moment to thank the team at Life Audio for partnering with us on this podcast. Be sure to go to lifeaudio.com and take a look at the other podcasts in their network. They've got shows about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more.
Is life feeling chaotic? I get it. I'm Rachel Wojo, host of the Untangling Life podcast. Don't miss the passionate encouragement and faith-based resources you need to help you clear your head and calm your heart. As Shell says, it feels like Rachel always knows what I need to hear. She keeps it real and is so humble. Her podcast is just the cherry on top. Enjoy Untangling Life with Rachel Wojo on lifeaudio.com or your favorite podcast app now.